All right, very good. Dr. Kim Frommi, I am officially welcoming you to our call as our first in our Visiting Scholars series. And you and I know each other well, and I'm quite confident that you indeed are a scholar who has a thing or two that you can teach us from your unique and very cool experiences with studying addictive behaviors. So, Kim, why don't you just introduce yourself and just explain what you do and anything you want to put in there. You do a lot of different interesting things. And then, you know, the questions are going to be all about your two topics that I find profoundly interesting. One of them is, since I've never had a bar laboratory, I'm certainly interested in what you're doing. And, of course, the other has to do with blackouts. Two great topics. So I'll shut up and listen to you.
Thanks, Bruce. Hopefully we'll get to blackouts. I started writing some notes, as we had talked about the alcohol challenge studies, and that could take a while. But anyway, so yes, thank you so much for inviting me and for people taking time out on their Friday to listen in. So I'm at the University of Texas at Austin. I've been here since, gosh, I guess 1993. I was at the University of Delaware prior to that for a number of years. I'm proud to say I'm one of the late G. Allen Marlatt's graduate students. We all still miss Allen tremendously, but I was very fortunate to benefit from his mentorship, and he really set me on the track that I'm on to be a strong mentor to graduate students, and that's certainly one of the things I most enjoy about being a professor, is mentoring undergraduate, graduate, and junior faculty members. So as Bruce said, I've been studying now for about the last 30 years the effects of alcohol education and evaluation of prevention programs for both alcohol use and related negative consequences or behaviors that people engage in while they're drinking. And it struck me as I was thinking about this call that not everyone is, you know, studying alcohol. There's a variety of addictions, and probably people on the call might be studying tobacco or drugs or any other form of addiction. And I think what I have to talk about, which I'll be focusing on, how best to understand or study the effects of alcohol on people, but I think they can equally be applied to the studies of other addictive behaviors.
Terrific. You can hear me, right?
I can.
I just want to remind everyone, except Kim, to please now put your phone on mute, because even the smallest amount of background noise can be cumulative. And it'll make life a lot easier if you do that. So please make sure you're on mute until you want to speak, and that'll be terrific. And Kim, please talk as close to your phone as you can if you're on a speakerphone, because this is really good stuff, and we want to preserve it, and we want to hear it on the recording. So let's continue.
Okay, great. I am on a speakerphone, and I've got guys climbing in trees in the backyard cutting them down. So if it gets too noisy, I'll pick up. So, Bruce, shall I just jump in?
Please do. You sound loud and clear now.
Okay, good. So the question, you know, I confronted in my research is, you know, what's the best way to understand and to study the effects of alcohol on people's behavior and cognition? So one way in which we do that, we all do it, we observe people, right? We observe people in natural drinking situations, and we all know a lot about the effects of alcohol on people as we observe them in terms of at lower doses getting maybe a little more talkative, outgoing, and at higher doses perhaps
Tyler.
Starting to engage in aggressive, reckless, or sexually provocative behavior. So we all do that at bars and parties and our own happy hours. So that's one of the first ways, of course, that scientists could study the effects of alcohol on people, is simply observe them in natural drinking situations. So So field studies do this. Field studies will go out and do actually observational studies, whether it be at tailgates. I know there's a study going on at UT now on football tailgates, that they're just going around to the tailgates and observing the people and taking notes. Other people have done field studies in which they've taken breathalyzers out and breathalyzed people as they leave bars or as they're going into bars and observing their behavior in those bars. So that's obviously a cool way to look at alcohol consumption in the natural environment. But the problem with it is we have virtually no control over the environmental factors, how much alcohol people drink, either before or during, who they're with, what else is going on, have they eaten, are they engaging in other activities. So whereas I think field studies can provide us with some interesting, you know, perhaps anecdotal and naturalistic observations, there's other ways to do alcohol administration in a more controlled environment, which then allows us to better control all the factors and be able to more specifically identify the effects of alcohol on cognition, behavior, et cetera. So when you think about doing those kinds of studies in a controlled environment, one type that Laura Ray is doing now out at UCLA is IV administration. So you can actually administer alcohol through an IV. You have very stringent control on the amount administered. You have the ability to maintain a relatively constant blood alcohol concentration over time and during testing, which all of that is great. But, you know, what's the problem here? How many of you consume alcohol via IV? Probably not many, right?
I assume that's, since you can't see our hands all raised, I'll tell you nobody's hands are up.
Yeah, it's sort of a rhetorical question, right? That's just not normal. We don't go into an IV bar and hook up for a drink. But again, it's provided some very valuable scientific data with respect to, you know, a great deal of precision about the effects of alcohol on people and obviously on animals as well, but I'm not focused on that. So oral administration, drinking, is the primary way in which all of us consume alcohol. So by doing that, you're getting closer to natural drinking. You can bring people into the laboratory. You can administer them alcohol. But you're still sort of in a sterile kind of laboratory environment. I mean, most of the alcohol research over the past 40 years has been done in, you know, basically like an office or a lab space. So you have no cues to trigger your alcohol-related beliefs or behaviors. Some of these studies also start at like 9 o'clock in the morning. Now, unless you're an alcoholic, that's probably not your normal time of drinking. So again, that steps you away from sort of the natural environment. So that's where the idea of a simulated bar laboratory came into existence. Peter Nathan at Rutgers and Alan Marlatt at the University of Washington had among the first, if not the first, simulated bar laboratories. And the idea was that you could present all the cues that people might associate with drinking. So the visual cues, the dim lighting, neon beer signs, booze bottles, glassware, the bar, the setting, auditory cues, music, olfactory cues, the smells. For example, we wipe down our bar with tequila before participants come in. So you walk into the bar and it reeks of alcohol. The one thing we don't have, and fortunately most bars don't now, is cigarette smoke. So we've maybe moved a step closer to the real bars now that many, many cities are going smoke-free. So what I've described in terms of the different ways of studying the effects of alcohol is one of the things I hope you notice is the trade-offs we have between ecological validity, that is, how real is this alcohol experience, versus experimental control. So in my research, I strive to maximize the ecological validity by using a simulated bar lab while also having good experimental controls. So in my studies, for example, participants consume alcohol or placebo, and I'll come back to that in just a minute, typically in mixed gender groups of, say, four people. They're tested individually, so they drink in the bar with these other individuals. That's where we dose them, and they absorb the alcohol. But then we take them to individual testing rooms so that their data are not contaminated and they're still individual data. It's one of the things I would encourage you to take note of when you read studies about alcohol administration or read alcohol administration studies, is take note of, you know, what's the setting, what's the composition of the group. Most of the research is done with a single subject drinking alone, may or may not be in a simulated bar situation. And I contend that we want, again, to try to maximize the ecological validity. So I said I'd come back to placebo. Most of the studies we do are placebo-controlled, meaning that half of our participants are told they're getting alcohol and get alcohol, and half the participants are told they're getting alcohol and we actually give them a placebo. Now, if you're like most of the folks I've talked to about this research, you're sitting there going, right, I would know whether or not my drink has alcohol in it. You could not fool me.
Exactly. That's such a bullseye.
I can almost guarantee you that we can.
Did you say can or can't?
Can, C-A-N.
Ah, so you can fool people that they're drinking alcohol.
Yes. Hey. I was actually challenged with this when I interviewed here at UT. You know, people were very skeptical about that, and a lot of faculty asked me questions about it. So when I got the laboratory, the bar constructed, we had an opening, a gala, and I invited all the faculty, and we did blind testing. I had two trays, and they could take a drink from only one of the trays. They couldn't compare them. And then to complete a ballot as to whether they got alcohol or placebo. And then one of my astute graduate students ran to the back room and ran analyses of it to show, indeed, those very smart UT faculty could not detect the difference.
Kim, this is a terrible question, but is it cheaper to get placebo than the real thing?
It totally is.
Okay.
So, you know, if you want to have a cheap party.
I was going to
say. Yeah. We go to quite elaborate procedures, though, so you might not want to bother with all of this. So, for example, what we use for our fake vodka, and most of the, I think, virtually all alcohol administration studies use vodka, because unless they're using, like, beer and non-alcoholic beer, because vodka is relatively odorless and tasteless. So that's why people use vodka. So for our fake vodka, we use decarbonated tonic water. We do that because tonic water, if you've ever consumed it, is kind of bitter. It has a kind of odd taste to it. So that's going to help us throw off people in terms of the taste of their beverage. So we decarbonate the tonic, we put it into vodka bottles, and we reseal the bottles. We have a mechanism that we're able to put a plastic container over it and heat seal it so that when it's presented in front of the participant, it looks like a brand new vodka bottle, and we open it before their very eyes. The other thing that you have to take great care in to create a realistic placebo is what goes into the drink. And we've done a lot of testing of this, and I can tell you, for example, that orange juice does not make a legitimate placebo. If you mix decarbonated tonic water with orange juice in the ratio that you would be making a mixed drink, it just tastes like weak orange juice. So we've developed what we call the Sahara Breeze. The Sahara is the name of my lab, studies on alcohol health and risky activities. So the Sahara Breeze has Diet Cherry 7-Up. Again, you might be familiar with diet drinks, can have a little kind of flavor to them. Not many people drink Diet Cherry 7-Up, cranberry juice, lime juice, and decarbonated tonic poured from those sealed vodka bottles. Then at the end, so that's a good mix. So you can't detect when you're drinking a Sahara Breeze whether it has alcohol in it or not. But we want to take it another step further because we really want people to get those olfactory cues, all the scents that they're actually drinking. So the glasses, before we've poured the drinks, are turned upside down onto a tray that has a towel that's soaked in vodka. So when you pick up the glass and turn it over, you have alcohol on the rim of the glass, you mix the drink into the glass, and then, of course, what mixed drink would not need a little squirt of lime juice on top, which is actually a heavy-duty mixture of lime juice and 100% alcohol. So then when you have your drink, the first thing you get is the smell of alcohol that's floating on the top. You put your lips to the glass and you get the initial taste of alcohol. So that's how you go about doing an effective placebo.
That is great. I don't know how many people on the call have bar labs, but just that information is worth its weight in gold. That's very good. Continue. And let me just remind everyone, if your phone isn't on mute, I think there may be one person. It sounds like a female voice clearing her throat in the background earlier. Please make sure your phone is on mute. But so far, it's been very clear. So continue.
Okay. So anyway, I was just going to say that, again, as you're evaluating studies dealing with alcohol challenge, I would encourage you to ask yourself, is this an effective placebo? And they should also have a manipulation check. Did people believe that they were really getting alcohol? Because if you're truly going to study the effects of expectancy versus pharmacology, you have to have an effective placebo. And I'll venture to say there are many very recent papers published out there that do not have an effective placebo.
Dr. Froman, how do you word the questionnaire in terms of finding out whether it's the manipulation check, whether they believe that it's alcohol or not?
We ask them, we tell them that, you know, this is a research study and we don't necessarily mix our drinks in the way that you might or a bartender might. So what we'd like you to tell us is how many standard drinks do you believe that you consumed?
Okay, great.
So that's how we get out of, because we serve them two drinks over a 20-minute period, and we don't want them to come back and just say two drinks. So we let them know that they're in different sizes of glasses. You know, we might be mixing them at a different strength. And so we want them to judge how much they consumed that would be of their standard beverages.
And do you mix the drinks in front of them?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So the bottles, the bartenders are undergraduate research assistants, and they are blind to beverage condition. So the graduate student prepares the vodka or placebo bottle ahead of time and has it placed in the refrigerator for the research assistants to use. So that way we can keep it as a double-blind placebo.
Sure. For my master's thesis, I did alcohol administration, and I mix the drinks in front of them, and there were some issues there in terms of trying to, they could see how much I was pouring, and so the wording of the manipulation checks got a little tricky.
Yeah, no, it's true, and it's a challenge. I mean, our bartender research assistants go through a tremendous amount of training because they have to be both measuring precisely as well as, you know, actively engaging with the participants in conversation. So we
have a consistent manner as well.
What's that?
Sorry.
I didn't hear you.
In a consistent manner so that it's the same across participants.
Exactly. So we actually, when we're running, you know, like four participants, we have two bartenders so that they can be, you know, carefully mixing and the others talking, et cetera. But yeah, and we're very careful about, you know, them maintaining a consistency across how they engage with the participants. And to monitor the participants' discussion. The participants are told that they shouldn't be talking about, you know, alcohol-related activities. And so the bartenders are trained to subtly change the topic of conversation if that should come up. Are there any other questions about sort of the procedures of an alcohol administration? Because I want to next talk about ad lib studies, and then I'll come back around and talk about sort of ethical considerations. But any questions so far about the administration?
I think you've been more thorough than I expected, which makes it way more interesting to me.
Uh-oh.
This is very detailed.
Okay. Well, maybe.
No, that's a compliment. I find the details here really interesting because I have seen, I was over at Kenny Scher's Bar Lab, and I don't know if you've been to that one, but it had gone through some transitions in the way they decorated it, and I think it was built out of just out of one of their offices, and so I was really curious about variability and how you control for variability across Bar Labs. So when you tell us to read the methods, I think it'd be so interesting if there were photos of different bar labs. People are interested in this kind of research, so they really get a feel for it. Kim, one thing you didn't mention is how many people, like what's an optimum number of people in the bar drinking at the same time or participating in the study at the same time? Is there one?
Well, I don't know if there's optimal, but we found that probably five is our maximum, just in terms of, you know, because we do measures on the ascending, the peak, and the descending blood alcohol curve. So you have to have basically a research assistant for each participant and a room, an individual room that they can go to for their testing. So just, you know, procedurally, any more than that gets pretty difficult. It's actually pretty difficult to run five people on a given night, and four is probably optimal in terms of people not running into each other going to testing rooms.
So,
very good. And
sorry, this is Lauren Hoffman. I'm just kind of curious because we've administered acute alcohol in our laboratory. It's not a in a bar setting, it's just a laboratory setting. But we've found that our placebos are more effective, much more effective in older adults than they are in younger adults. I think it was between 80 and 90% of the older adults would report that they received alcohol, and we check that by just asking them, do you think you received alcohol? Because they know they have a 1 in 3 chance of receiving a placebo. And so your participants, are they middle-aged, young adults, older adults, or do you have a range?
That's a fascinating issue, Lauren. Our participants are typically, I mean, most of the previous alcohol challenge studies I've done, they've averaged around 21.5. You know, obviously they have to be over 21. And if we just recruit, you know, around the campus community, we get younger people. Right now we're re-recruiting individuals who were first recruited in 2004 as entering freshmen at UT. We've been tracking them now. This is our 10th year, so they're about 27. And that's really the oldest folks that I've actually run in my studies, Lauren.
Okay, and your placebos seem to be effective in those groups.
They are.
And that might be a difference of setting then, because we don't mix our drinks. And in terms of what we're mixing it with.
Yes. That's just critical, Lauren. I mean, we've tested a lot of different mixtures to come up with this. And again, as I said, you know, vodka and orange juice, that would be a go-to, right? Does not work as a credible placebo. So you really want to be sure that you test out your placebo on your research assistants.
Right. The other thing that I've kind of heard in the field is there's a little bit of controversy about what you mix it with. So if you're mixing it with a solution that's high in sugar and or caffeine, and you're testing the effects on cognition, you have to be careful with what you're mixing your alcohol with.
Yeah, I don't know so much about the sugar content, but that's certainly the case with any kind of caffeinated beverages. And there's some pretty cool ongoing studies, as I'm sure you're familiar with, about the current craze of mixing, you know, like vodka and Red Bull.
Yeah.
We haven't studied that. One of the things that we struggle with, and Will Corbin at Arizona State and I have collaborated for years now, and he has his second bar lab. His first one at Yale was exactly patterned off the blueprints of mine, and now his one at ASU is really high-end. I think it's probably the coolest bar lab around. But anyway, he's doing an alcohol challenge right now, as am I, and we're always sort of offsetting the carbonation, which makes it a palatable beverage, but it also sort of feeds the absorption versus a non-carbonated like the cranberry juice, which gives you a slower rise in ascending BAC, but tends to be able to keep people at a sort of plateau longer than a straight carbonated beverage. So we struggled with that with respect to getting sort of the optimal mixture. The other thing that we've been doing, just one more methodological piece, is the issue, you know, we tell people not to eat for like 4 hours before they come in an attempt to, you know, have comparable contents in their stomach. You know, invariably somebody comes in and they've just, you know, had a Big Mac and a large order of fries. But, you know, theoretically, they're supposed to come in fasting. So Will started this in his lab, and we're doing it to match his methodology, but giving a weight-adjusted caloric snack. We're actually using pretzels. Based on their weight, we give them a certain number of pretzels a certain amount of time before we're going to give them the alcohol, in an effort to sort of reach comparable blood alcohol concentrations. I tell you, there's a lot of variables in doing this research. You can try to control it as best you can, but there's still people, and there's still individual variability. You know, it's not like they're mice that you just go get them out of a cage, and you know how much they've eaten, and you know how they're bred, and you know what their alcohol sensitivity is. So anytime a group of alcohol researchers get together, we always bemoan the fact of how difficult it is to reach and maintain a consistent blood alcohol concentration. So if there's not any other questions about that, I just wanted to raise another way to study alcohol consumption in a laboratory is ad lib self-administration. So I was talking about dosing people to a particular, giving them a certain amount of alcohol so that they would reach a certain blood alcohol level, typically 0.08 in our and most other studies you'll see. But another thing is well, what do people self-administer, and what factors cause people to drink more or less? Like, do people drink when they're anxious? We believe that they do. So you bring them into the laboratory. You make them anxious. You ask them to give a self-disclosing speech about what they like and dislike about their body. And then while they're preparing the speech, you say, and hey, would you like a drink? So we've done some of those studies. The first studies looking at self-administration were done in the 80s. Alan Marlatt did some of these, and they were taste rating tasks. So the participants were brought in, and they would have like three different vodka tonics in front of them, and they were told that these are three different brands of vodka, or if they're in the placebo or the no alcohol, three different kinds of tonic. And they just need to taste them and rate them. Are they bitter? Are they clean on the palate? Are they et cetera, et cetera? And they're just told drink as much or as little as you need to make these ratings. And, of course, it's actually a measure of how much you drink. They know how much they gave you to begin with. The research assistant removes it at the end of the time, measures what's left, and that's how much you drank. And that's how they discovered the phenomenon of modeling. So if you sit somebody down to do the taste rating task, and then you pair them with a confederate, somebody they believe is another participant, but in fact they're a research assistant, and you train the research assistant to either drink heavily, slug it down while they're tasting, or just to take little tiny sips. And what's been discovered is that the participant will match the model drink for drink, sip for sip. What I find fascinating about that is it appears to be a totally unconscious process, because when they debriefed those participants and said, hey, you know, what did you notice about, you know, your fellow participants drinking? And they said, you know, I really didn't pay any attention. I don't know how much he or she drank, and it certainly didn't influence my consumption. So I thought those studies were pretty cool. Any questions about the ad lib studies? One of the things that I did an ad lib study for my dissertation. It was a huge study. You'll never see it published. I quit doing ad lib studies after that because of the following. You can recruit your subjects and you can tell them it's an alcohol study, and please do not sign up for it if they have an exam tomorrow, if they need to study, if they have anything going on the next day that would prevent them, you know, or they shouldn't be drinking. And they agree, and they come in, and invariably they'll say, now what time are we going to be finished? Because I have an exam tomorrow, and I really need to get home to study. So they don't drink very much. So that's when I quit doing ad lib studies. And they have a way that they can sleep over, or I can put them in a little cage afterwards. It's really a challenge. So the next thing to deal with in any of these administration studies is what can you test? You know, what are you actually looking for? We've talked about how you can administer alcohol and get people to certain blood alcohol levels. But what if the question you have is something like, how does alcohol affect the decision to drink and drive? or how does alcohol affect the decision to have risky sex? Well, I don't know about you guys, IRB, but ours frowns on offering them, you know, prostitutes or the opportunity to get in the car after they're driving. So that's a quandary. How do you measure what you really want to study? And so people use proxy measures. They might use vignettes of sexual situations or videotapes or a driving simulator. Or more likely, they might just use self-report. So they, when people are intoxicated, they go, well, ask about their intention. What's the likelihood that right now, if you had the opportunity to have sex with this person or to drive or to use these drugs or whatever, what's the likelihood you would do it? And that's about what we're left with a lot of these behaviors rather than actual behavior. The alternative in terms of looking at risk-taking is people have done hypothetical gambles or gambles for small amounts of money. But you have to ask yourself, how realistic is that? You know, somebody gambling for a nickel, is that really reflective of their gambling behavior? Or if they say, no, of course I wouldn't have sex with this person, or only if I had a condom, does that really reflect what their actual behavior would be in the heat of the moment? So another way that we have tried to get at some of these is with behavioral tasks. So lots of studies these days, including my lab, use behavioral tasks such as the go stop task to measure people's behavioral inhibition to see, does alcohol reduce your ability to inhibit your behavior? The Iowa gambling task is another behavioral measure of risk taking. I'm sure some of you have heard of or used the BART, which is this balloon task, computerized task that you pump the balloon with air and you get paid more, like a nickel or a quarter, the larger the balloon gets, but if it bursts, then you lose all your money. So again, those are some
great
efforts.
I've never heard of that.
So Bruce, anything else about that you think I should cover? Shall we move into ethical considerations?
Okay. Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
What kind of doses, what kind of blood alcohol levels are you dosing people to in your lab?
We are dosing to a 0.08.
Right,
and that is, I'd say, about 99% of alcohol challenge studies use 0.08 as an upper end. I think that's in part because of Human Subjects Review Board concerns.
Yeah.
But I can also tell you, I've run a study in which we dosed to 0.12.
Right.
The upper end, and you will not see that paper published anywhere because it was a complete and utter bust. People were so drunk, they couldn't even find the paper, to much less circle their answers.
Oh, my God. Really?
Good data. So, you know, I think you're getting to a point, a really great point, that is a limitation of these laboratory studies, is we're limiting them typically to a BAC of 0.08, and we know for a fact that when most people are drunk driving or engaging in some of these other risky behaviors, they're probably closer to a BAC of 0.2. I mean, they're like 2.5 times legal intoxication.
Mm.
So that's a real limitation.
Yeah.
So anything else or on to ethical consideration?
I have a question.
Go for it.
I was just wondering if you try to take into account tolerance in
this dosing situation. If somebody has a heavy drinking history, 0.08 may not be, the same.
No, it's a great point. And, you know, it's difficult to take tolerance into account in terms of the dosing protocol itself. You can certainly use that in doing your analyses, you know, as co-vary out their drinking history to look at the effects. But it'd be pretty hard to know exactly how to alter, you know, your algorithm, I think, based on tolerance.
Thank you.
We're currently using an algorithm developed by John Curtin, and I've talked extensively to him about, you know, other things that we might, you know, take under consideration, because we're hitting close to our target, which is 0.06 on the ascending and on the descending, and 0.08 at the peak. But boy, when you look at a plot of the curves, I presented them at RSA this past year, you see tremendous variability within that. So you're certainly hitting on something, and tolerance is really vital. I do battle a lot of times. I don't know that we're going to get to blackouts or the expert witness testimony that I provide in the courts. But that's one of the battles, is people want to be able to say, okay, at a BAC of 0.18, how should this person have looked, sounded, acted, felt? And you can find charts on that. There's one on the NIAAA website. There's one called the Dabowski chart. But if you look at those, there's just so much variability, individual differences. I find them completely useless. So on to ethics. We got 15 minutes by my count.
That'd be wonderful. A lot of my questions have to do with ethics, so that'd be awesome.
Okay. So, you know, you have to start out with who are you going to study, right? And one question that the field has grappled with is, do you give alcohol to alcoholics? And years ago, in the 50s, 60s, maybe even into the 70s, the answer was yes. Then it became no. NIAAA and ethical guidelines forbid it. And now we're back to yes under certain conditions, and those conditions meaning that the individual is not attempting to abstain. On the other end of the spectrum, you might ask, can you give alcohol to naive drinkers? Wouldn't that be cool? Getting back to the question that was raised about tolerance, how about if we were able to do this before they developed any tolerance? Let's give alcohol to adolescents or to children. No, we can't do that. What about we have to only run participants who are over 21. And by the way, at least my IRB would not even approve a placebo for anyone under 21 because it was viewed as condoning underage drinking, even though we're fooling them. So then the question, how about very light drinkers? Again, the answer is no. So our participants must report self-administering the same or more than the amount of alcohol that we'll be giving them. So we screen, for example, our participants have to report that they have previously consumed 3 or more drinks in a given drinking occasion. Even so, you always risk the chance if you have somebody who doesn't typically drink 3 drinks or doesn't typically drink liquor, that they might get sick. And that's not a pleasant thing for the graduate students to deal with, as you can imagine. So we try to sort of hit that middle ground. So getting people who have enough drinking experience, they can tolerate getting to a 0.08 BAC over a relatively quick time. So we do a lot of screening. for protections of our participants. So we screen for any contraindications to drinking. So we screen for alcohol use disorders, for medications, for medical conditions, for religious or other objections to drinking. Women actually have to take a pregnancy test in the laboratory that evening. They also can't be nursing. So you also, in doing this for 30 years, women haven't always had to take pregnancy tests. We used to just be able to believe them. We could ask them, are you pregnant or is there any chance you're pregnant? But for about the last 20 years, I'd say, we have to give pregnancy tests. I'm happy to report that only one time have we had a positive pregnancy test.
I can't resist. Was that a surprise to your subject?
Well, it was a surprise to the research assistant, I can tell you that. But they have,
that'd be
a
weird way to find out you're pregnant.
Right. We have a protocol for how to handle that, you know, which is to take them into private area and, you know, how to tell them this. And it turned out that the participant was actually excited about it, so that was a good thing. But then, of course, they were excused from participating in the study. And the last thing we do is they do a breathalyzer. So they have to blow a 0-0 at the beginning of the study, so they can't come in having already consumed alcohol. And yes, some do, and they have to be turned away. We'll reschedule them once. If they show up drunk twice, they're out. And then after they blow a breathalyzer, we do a very extensive consent form. Our consent form is probably 4 single-space pages, covering all possible things, like this alcohol could make you feel intoxicated.
Kim, one thing that might be very helpful is, especially like with a consent form like that, if you are comfortable with us posting that on our website for other investigators, that might be very, very helpful. Or anything else you do that's protocol-like. You know, I don't know how much of that you can or want to make available, but that would be very helpful.
Sure. I could definitely do the consent form. I don't think I want our placebo procedures out on the internet for potential participants.
No. I wasn't thinking those. No, just having your consent form, I think, would be really nice. Even the instructions for if you find that you have someone pregnant. One of my thoughts here is, you know, I'm on our IRB, and these are good resources for not only investigators but also people that evaluate protocols and studies like yours, where there's some risk and alcohol related to the study. So that would
sure.
be great.
Yeah,
so continue. Unfortunately, we only have 10 minutes, but I want to hear more.
Well, there'll be differences too, Bruce, in the IRB. So, for example, the NIAAA guidelines, which there are NIAAA guidelines for alcohol administration studies, and I would encourage people to access those on the NIAAA website. But it specifies that you can release people. So we have to keep people in the lab, right, until they're sober or relatively sober. The newest guidelines that came out, probably 10 years ago now, specify a BAC of 0.04 that participants can be excused from the study when they get down to 0.04 as long as they are provided transportation home. And it must be home, not to a bar, not to a party, not even to the library. But some IRBs will require that the BAC go down all the way to 0-0. And that's a huge difference. That probably is a difference in the research assistant staying in the lab another 2 to 3 hours. So
that does raise a question that you would be familiar with. Is it accurate that the body metabolizes a standard drink approximately every hour? Is that a guideline that's a reasonable one, where so that you could calculate it using that metric?
That's about accurate, Bruce. Elimination rates range from 0.015 to 0.02, roughly, per hour. So that can equate to roughly a drink an hour, but I certainly wouldn't encourage people to use that as a guideline of knowing, you know, when they're safe to drive, for example.
Thank you.
Sure. So I just thought I'd end up with some limits on these human alcohol studies. So I think we've touched on most of them, is the first being dose, that people are often engaging in, you know, drinking and engaging in these behaviors at much higher blood alcohol levels than we can ethically study in the laboratory. We're oftentimes left with measures that are only proxies for the behavior. And regardless of our efforts to enhance ecological validity, this is still never going to be the individual's actual drinking environment. So, you know, those are all limitations to keep in mind. I had planned to use this as the segue into blackouts, Bruce, but I don't know if we have time to talk about that. But that certainly raises tremendous challenges about, you know, a phenomenon that's very important, but how do you actually study it in the lab?
Oh, that's terrific. What I'll do, we have lots of people online, and they have, the reason why we don't know that is because they've done a beautiful job of pressing the mute button, or else it would be really noisy. So why don't we just throw it, that question out there. If you have questions specifically about anything that's been said relating to Bar Labs, please ask them now, or if you want Dr. Frommi to proceed with anything on blackouts. And I will parenthetically say or ask, is Don Goodwin, who used to be here at KU, who used to get people in his lab so drunk that he was actually, I guess, testing how much can people drink without getting in a lot of trouble, are those sort of gold standards for how not to do research anymore? Are you familiar with old Don Goodwin?
Oh, I am. I mean, bless Don Goodwin's heart. I mean, I have a review paper of his and other people's studies back in the day when they really could study blackouts, because they dosed people to like 0.30.
Wow. Well, he was the chair of our psychiatry department when I started working here, and
I didn't know that.
Yes, he was. And I think he may have come from Wash U over to KU. But my entire early years, 10 years maybe of being at KU Medical Center, was with regular contact with Don Goodwin. And someday, Kim, you and I, sitting at a real bar, we'll talk about Don Goodwin. How's that?
That sounds great.
So
we
have
draw on research on blackouts.
Yes. So you guys, please ask questions, and let's use the last 5 minutes really well.
This is Tony again. Could you just maybe speak to what, in a summary, what we know about blackouts as to when the probability of occurring are, or just an overview of what you think are important facts about blackouts?
Sure.
Tony, thanks for that. That would have been my question. I'm really glad you asked it. Kim, please tell us everything in the minutes you have left. That'd be great.
Okay. Well, basically, let's be sure everybody knows what a blackout is. It's not being passed out from alcohol. So blackout is amnesia for all or part of a drinking event, as opposed to passing out when an individual loses consciousness. Tony, our research has shown that they can occur at BACs as low as 0.07. We haven't identified any prior to that, and that's through, you know, daily monitoring and estimating BACs. Both Aaron White and I agree that most blackouts occur at BACs around 0.15 and above, and fragmentary blackouts are more common than, which is just bits and pieces of memory loss, are more common than on block blackouts, which is complete memory loss for a period of time. We know a number of different risk factors. Women are more likely to have blackouts than men. You're more likely to have a blackout if you're drinking hard liquor and you're drinking fast. Basically, anything that makes the blood alcohol concentration rise more quickly will give you a greater likelihood of having a blackout. But that said, what's completely fascinating to me is only about 50% of drinkers who drink to the level you need to drink to experience blackouts actually have blackouts. So we're beginning to look at sort of the genetic basis for that. So we study it by recruiting people who do and do not experience blackouts. And then we've done memory tasks of them. We've done one fMRI study. And the study we're doing now, we have DNA on these participants. So we're beginning to think about how to look at the potential candidate genes and genomic underpinnings of blackouts.
Tell us more about blackouts.
That was a lot in a minute.
I know it was. I think you answered this, but I'll ask it again. Do we know what happens to the brain during a blackout? Is there anything that's measurable? Is there anything that's observable? When you're with somebody who says the next day, I don't remember doing that, you don't know that they will black out the moment you had with them where you reminded them. Isn't that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's ends up being key in a lot of criminal cases is the fact that there is no objective observable indices of someone being in a blackout. When testifying, I use the example of it's similar to the fact that you don't know whether I have a headache right now, because the headache would only be happening inside my own brain, because during a blackout, a person is walking, talking, conversing, dancing, having sex, driving, buying airline tickets online, high-level cognitive functions and behavior. So the observer would have absolutely no way of knowing they were in a blackout.
Does a blackout correlate with levels of misbehavior? Are you just as likely to be in a blackout when, you're sitting, having a nice dinner with people you're chatting with as if you do something terrible, illegal, or whatever? I mean, is there a correlation because it's dose related?
Dose-related, so you may be more likely to be in a situation where you would misbehave if you're that intoxicated, but you're just as likely to black out about brushing your teeth as you are about having sex.
That's what I was asking. That's so interesting. I am really sorry to say that we've just hit our hour. I speak for more than just myself when I say this was fascinating. Anyone who cares to take their phone off a mute to say that they think it was fascinating or say thank you, please feel free. And I've never asked that before, but heck, it's weird. I'm sure it's weird being a guest not knowing who the heck is listening or how many. I heard David Eddy laughing. David?
Yeah, it was great. It really was. So glad I checked in.
Terrific.
Yeah, very informative. It was awesome. Thank you.
All the voices are.
I want to chime in too. I find that I've been very curious about blackouts, and I only caught the last few minutes, but this was very helpful.
Oh, thank you.
Who is this?
It's Mark Schenker.
Mark, thank you for hopping on. All right,
I was just evaluating a guy who drinks a fifth a day and never had a blackout in his life. So, go figure.
You know, 50% that doesn't. But we've got a couple of papers out on blackouts. One's in addictive behaviors. Another one is going to be coming out in, I believe, in PAB. And then Reagan Witherell and I are working on a new review paper of blackouts that has been invited by ACER.
I think a good way to end is to say we welcome you sending us any PDFs that you want to link to our Division 50 blog site, or any we can even link to your website, your lab website, if you like. Dr. Kim Frommi, thank you. As always, I just enjoy the heck out of spending time with you, whether it's on a conference call or in real life.
I feel the same way, Bruce. Thank you so much for inviting me, and thanks again to everyone for taking the time to be on today.
Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank
okay,
you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello.